This is Maine Currents, independent local news, views, and culture. I'm Amy Brown. The Abbey Museum was founded in 1926, and I'm going to read you some of the notes from their website about their history. They first opened to the public in 1928, and it's named for founder Dr. Robert Abbey, who lived from 1851 to 1928 and was an eminent New York physician known for his pioneering use of radiation therapy. He was a summer resident of Bart Harbor, and during the 1920s, that is, Dr. Abbey assembled a collection of early Native American artifacts found in the Frenchman Bay area. He then persuaded others with similar collections to join him in establishing a museum that would protect these objects and display them for public education and enjoyment. The museum opened as a private museum at Sordemont Springs in Lafayette National Park, which later was renamed Acadia National Park, on August 14, 1928, and it was dedicated to the memory of Dr. Abbey, who had died earlier that year. Also in 1928, the Abbey became the first institution in Maine to sponsor archaeological research. The museum continued to conduct extensive excavations and later expanded its archaeological research throughout Maine. The Abbey's collections now represent 12,000 years of Native American culture and history in Maine, and the conservation program has been recognized nationally as a model for museums. The Abbey Museum's mission is, quote, to illuminate and advance greater understanding of and support for the Wabanaki Nation's heritage, living cultures, and homelands. Over the years, WERU has done several shows about the Abbey Museum and their approach to decolonization. One of the first ones that I can find, it's still on our archives, all of these that I'm going to mention are if you're interested in going and finding them, is from 2007. Rhonda Fry and Meredith DeFrancesco were co-hosting a program at the time called Indigenous Voices. Donna Loring did a program about the Abbey Museum and their tribal historic preservation officer in 2014 that also looked at some other museums in the area and how they were run. Ron Beard, the next year, did a program on the Abbey Museum in 2015, January, on Bridging Wabanaki and White People and Cultures was the title. In 2018, Donna Loring did a program on Wabanaki Windows on decolonization, followed a few years later in July of 2020 by a program on Maine Currents on decolonization that featured the Abbey. Since that time, the Abbey's been discussed, or at least mentioned, on several other programs, including Common Ground Radio in September of 2021 on traditional foodways, Climate and Community in July of 2024 on the Dawnland Festival, Talk of the Towns in May of 2019, the Abbey Museum and the Road to Decolonization, Conversations from the Pointed Firs in June of 2021, talked to Chris Newell of the Abbey Museum about the museum as storyteller and keeper of historical art, artifact, and authenticity. And in 2022, Dawnland Signals, a program that was hosted by Wabanaki Reach, Maria Gerard and Esther Ann, did a program called Decolonizing Museums, the Abbey and the Wilson Museums together. They talked about both of the museums. So there's a lot of background on the WERU archives if you're interested. Just go to the Spoken Word Archives and type Abbey, A-B-B-E, in the search box and it will bring up the program's descriptions that mention that in their name. Also, you'll want to check out Wabanaki Windows, which Donna Loring has been hosting for about 16 years now. Wabanaki Windows is a monthly show. It airs on the fourth Tuesday of every month from 4 to 5 p.m. here on WERU, and it features topics of interest from a Wabanaki perspective. Donna just this year won a Hometown Media Award for the show in the category of racial justice and civil rights. And an exhibition has just opened at the Abbey Museum, named in honor of Donna Loring's 2008 book, In the Shadow of the Eagle. And Donna's one of the curators of the exhibition. But what does that mean exactly, and how was it all connected with the decolonization work that the Abbey's been doing for many years now? Last week, we sat down with Donna Loring, as well as Professor Darren Ranko, who's a co-curator on the exhibit and a regular contributor to Wabanaki Windows with Donna, Betsy Richards, the executive director of the Abbey Museum, and Dr. Aaron Miller, the loose curator of exhibits at the Abbey, and James Francis, a commissioned artist whose work is displayed in the exhibition.
I'm Betsy Richards. I'm a citizen of the Cherokee Nation, and I'm the executive director of the Abbey Museum in Bar Harbor. And I started this role in fall of 2022 and really have been incredibly moved and was excited about the Abbey's decolonization positioning and true collaboration with Wabanaki Nations and what we would now call Maine. And in coming up with the idea, I was speaking to a funder, was thinking about upcoming exhibitions. We were at a, was right after COVID, small skeleton staff. I had met Donna and was aware of her book, had read her book, and really felt like folks weren't aware of the kind of, with the upcoming 250th anniversary of the United States, weren't really aware of the role that Wabanaki people and others, other tribal nations in the Northeast have played around not only the kind of protection and formation of the democracy, but both the kind of participation in, but also how it reflected and how there were really civil rights and human rights struggles in the midst of all of this, that this wasn't the simplistic picture that most, or the picture of disappearance that folks see. And I felt really strongly, I remember writing to Donna and asking her if we could use the title of her book as a working title. So I'll leave it at that. That was kind of the beginnings. And then we were given a planning grant by the Terra Foundation for American Art to proceed with that basic idea.
All right. Do you want to pick it up from there, Donna? You got the phone call. What did you think?
Well, I had met Betsy probably one time before. We had hockey pucks for lunch.
But not such great hamburgers.
Yeah, we won't say where. So when I got that email, I thought, what the heck? You know, why not? I had no idea why she chose that title, but I thought, great, yeah, sure. If you want to use my book as a title for something, go for it. So that's what I was thinking.
Can you say a little bit about the book? It came out in 2008. There may be some people who aren't aware of it. There was a lot more buzz back then, but the book is still available. I checked today.
Yeah, the title of the book is In the Shadow of the Eagle, a Tribal Representative in Maine. And when I wrote that book, it was sort of, my thought was I would pass that information on to the next tribal rep because I came in not knowing a thing about what I was supposed to do. So I sort of started writing it for that purpose. And then as the sessions went on and I was writing every day, sort of journaling, I thought, well, this is really something that the public should know as well. So that's how I turned it into a book. And it took me a long time to get it published because nobody wanted to publish it because they thought, well, you're naming names here and, you know, we might get into trouble if we publish it. But, you know, if you tell the truth, you're not going to get into trouble. So
I've always wondered if you're going to do a follow-up book and when that's coming out.
Well, you know, it's funny. I started to do a follow-up and I went down a rabbit hole, and the rabbit hole is called One Nation Under Fraud. And a remonstrance. So, and that's in the law journal at the law school now. And we had a seminar on that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I did plan on doing a follow-up and I still kind of do, but we'll see.
All right. So what happened next? You said, okay, you approved of the name for the exhibition. And how long ago was that?
My name's Aaron Miller. I am a settler descendant and the curator of exhibits and collections at the Abbey Museum. And so when I came on about 2 years ago, we were lucky to have the planning grant in place for this project. So I work closely with the curators and advisory group to help facilitate the show. And I guess one of the first steps was to bring on the curators, reach out to Donna officially, Dr. Dan Renko and Sierra Height, who was at Colby College at that time, and talk a little bit more about the project. And we were very fortunate that they all wanted to be part of it. And then from there, we discussed as a group to bring in advisors from the Four Nations, and really kind of went from there.
I'm Darren Ranko. I'm a Penobscot Nation citizen and chair of Native American Programs, professor of anthropology at the University of Maine, and one of the co-curators. You know, I think the inspiration of In the Shadow of the Eagle, which I actually want Donna to say more about the meaningfulness of that title, because I don't think I'd do it particularly well. But I think one of the things that the book is good at kind of exposing or struggling with is the idea that, you know, we are caught up as Wabanaki people, right? We are caught up in these like official anniversaries of the settler state, right, of the United States. So we're responding to this moment seemingly of the 250th anniversary of the United States coming into being. And I think I was really drawn to using the book as a framing, because I think the book uses the framing of, well, this is more like, let's put the United States or the state of Maine into our narrative as Wabanaki people or as Indigenous people or Penobscot people, as opposed to like, we're going to be telling a story of our struggles under these 250 years. You know, I think we're using the opportunity as something like, oh, the United States kind of happened to us, right? As opposed to we're in celebration or you know, we have, I think probably more profoundly, we have influenced, right, or had a hand in what how the United States has worked or not worked, and have obviously been subject to it. But it is part of a larger narrative for us around our relations with each other as Wabanaki nations, our relations with our homelands, but then also what does it mean to kind of engage with and be a nation or be in this larger conversation of nations to one another. So I think, you know, we really, really tried to pull forward the narratives that document, you know, not like us responding exactly to the American state, but us trying to dictate or frame it in ways that we can understand and how we've participated in it. And I think, you know, you see that in the various, you know, emphasis that we may place on veterans, Wabanaki veterans in particular, but also different forms of resistance and participation in democracy, and how we, you know, for us as Wabanaki people, democracy goes back a lot longer than 250 years, right? So we have our own forms of sort of democracy, direct democracy forms that we still practice. So I think to me that was the power of using the book as the frame, because it asks a lot of those same questions, which is like, how does our state representative make sense of, you know, being in this legislature, which within which she has no vote, right? You know, so like, how do we kind of think about our participation or our relations with the United States and of course the state of Maine, et cetera, in this broader project?
So, Darren, my thought of using, you know, titling the book In the Shadow of the Eagle had to do with the spiritual meaning, symbol of the eagle and its strength and its power, and the fact that we believe that our ancestors see through the eyes of the eagle and, you know, and protect us and watch over us. And on the other hand, this, you know, there's another part to it, and you know, that's the colonial aspect of the eagle, and that's more like power and you know, it's a bird of prey, and you know, they look at it as a symbol of control and strength and power and that sort of thing, which is totally opposite of, not even opposite, it's not even in the same level as what we think of the eagle. So it's like two separate different worlds. And in, you know, as in the exhibit and in the book, these worlds come together at sometimes, and when they do, they clash and things break. And a lot of times the breakage is on our part. and we're always picking up and all trying and moving forward. So.
I'm James Eric Francis Sr., and I am the Director of the Cultural and Historic Preservation for the Penobscot Nation. I also serve as an appointed Penobscot tribal member on the Abbey Council. And for this exhibit, I was actually an artist, a contributing artist, kind of turning the clock back a little bit. You know, we're talking about the 250th anniversary of kind of the Declaration of Independence, 1776. And from a Wabanaki perspective, a year earlier, on June 21st, 1775, we had a 250th anniversary of Chief Joseph Orono going to Watertown to ally Wabanaki troops with the Revolutionary Americans. And so I wanted to do a piece that represented his travel to Watertown, and painted a piece that shows Chief Joseph Orono and an elder matriarch in the community paddling to Watertown. And the piece is called Circa June 20th, 1775. So it was the day before the signing. And I wanted to incorporate elements of something that Chief Joseph Orono had held in his hand. And it was a piece that is at the Abbey Museum, and that is his powder horn. And so in the sky above the canoeist are these scrimshaw etchings taken from his powder horn in the sky of a ship, of a man looking at the ship with a kind of an old timey pipe, and then a soldier with a gun. And I kind of imagined that those images from the powder horn, but also from those are thoughts that Orono may have had on that journey. And as he was making his way to Watertown to ally Wabanaki troops.
James, I'd like you to talk a little bit more. There's a couple more images in your piece of art. One is the matriarch, and the other is the moon. You want to say something about those two things? Because I think they're important.
Yeah. So when I was laying out the figures to be paddling in the canoe, I was very thoughtful about where to place the woman. And, you know, we come from a culture that really places the authority on the clan system and clan mothers. And oftentimes when we talk about, you know, being in a canoe, the leadership tends to be in the stern of the canoe. And so I wanted to place the woman in the stern of the canoe and Joseph Orono in the bow of the canoe. And they're both in traditional ceremonial dress. He's got a headdress on, he's got a collar and cuff on, and they probably wouldn't have traveled that way, but she has a peaked cap on, and their clothing isn't clothing at all. It mirrors the sky. So there's this connection between the natural world and their beings themselves in the piece. And looking over the whole piece, over the whole scene is Grandmother Moon. And you can see a face of an elder woman looking over the canoe. And I was very deliberate. I actually got on the internet and figured out what phase of the moon June 20th, 1775 would have been, and created that within the work and used that phase of the moon in this piece. So there's all these little layers and these signals, and the complete painting is done in dots, this very circular dots. And it's it takes a long time, and it also takes, I have to create mathematical equations to ensure that dots are placed across the canvas evenly, and I incorporated the dates to create, you know, the 6, the 21, and the 75 to create that mathematical equation. So to make sure the gradients came out right, because when you're using dots, you can, it's hard to stay consistent across a canvas that's 40 inches by 30 inches. And so there was this mathematical equation that was created. So that's really where I was coming from. I wanted to embody a lot in a very, with seemingly a very simple painting.
You're listening to Maine Currents on WERU-FM. The guests are talking about the exhibition at the Abbey Museum in Bar Harbor, which just opened, named in honor of Donna Loring's book, In the Shadow of the Eagle. The guests are Donna Loring, who also hosts Wabanaki Windows here on WERU, among other things, Betsy Richards, the executive director of the Abbey Museum, Dr. Aaron Miller, the loose curator of exhibits at the Abbey, Professor Darren Ranko, who is one of the co-curators of the exhibit and also a regular guest on Wabanaki Windows, and James Francis, an artist commissioned as part of the project.
I think James's piece is like a really, obviously it's one of just a few works that were commissioned. Other works were borrowed or begged. I think it's, you know, James's piece, first of all, it's amazing to look at, which I cannot emphasize enough. But also, this weaving of different themes around and through images, I think, captures. I think on the one hand, we have, you know, a series of pieces that are engaging with the eagle as a character, and I think that is fundamental because of Donna's setup around that, because of how, as Wabanaki people, we understand the eagle as creating a form of sight. The eagle also appears, you know, and I'm thinking like Maria Gerard's piece, like as a reminder of our, you know, how important our caretaking of our places can and should be, you know, in terms of things like dam removal or, you know, where you have an eagle getting a fish, like, you know, for a long time because of dams and other things, you know, these eagles have not been able to thrive in our territory and have the fish there that they depend upon. So, you know, there's also all sorts of weavings around that. And I think the last one too that you see come up, the eagle, the different kind of formulations of engaging with the United States as an entity. And then lastly, and probably most importantly, as I mentioned before, that our governance, our democracy, you know, which is represented through our diplomacies in the wampum records and our use of wampum to formulate agreements and treaties and forms of democracy before there was the United States. You see all of those different sort of weaving pieces coming together. So it's visually quite rich because you have characters like eagle and other non-humans, and even, you know, our non-human relations are important in our diplomacy and our agreements. Our first treaties are with non-humans, right, as Wabanaki people. But then you also see like how, you know, the wampum tradition and is blended and woven through our frameworks for democracy and how we even engage with this thing called the United States, right? Where we're exchanging wampum with we're trying to incorporate them into our traditions, right? Of like, this is how you make a proper agreement. It's not a, you know, sign here written thing. It's a exchanging of a wampum belt is the engagement is a beginning of a process and a relationship, not so much a signing of an agreement. So I think that you see all of that visually in so many of the pieces. There's baskets, of course, we love baskets, but so many of the baskets are weaving these different framings and stories of wampum, of relationality, of the United States, of these different kinds of themes. So I think it the richness that James described in his piece is really represented in so many of the other pieces.
Yeah, I'd just like to say, I'm sorry, Donna, but okay. I'll be quick. I'd just like to say a few words about, this is a contemporary art show. It sounds a little bit, it can be easily seen as like a history lesson or something like that. And just to kind of pull apart that it was always conceived to reach people through the voices of Wabanaki and other Northeastern artists, right? And it does have historical and things on the walls. So the didactics, the labeling is very much tells the story from a Wabanaki perspective. But it's the power of artists like James Francis, or many of the other contemporary artists that are there that are just the way the In the Shadow of the Eagle tells a multi-dimensional story. We felt like we could reach a very, we could reach somewhere beyond just words by showing the art of Wabanaki artists really kind of engaging with this theme from their own perspectives.
So, as I was going to say, the piece of the artwork that Maria Gerard did struck me because, you know, it's an eagle with an alewife. The title is Eagle Catching the Alewife. And when I saw that picture, it took me back, because I go into history a lot. It took me back to when I was reading about the, I think it was like the 1700s, we were negotiating for a dam to be torn down in the southern part of Maine so that the fish could reach our tribes and whatever. And it took me to the point where when I was a senior advisor to Governor Mills, we were in this meeting in her cabinet room, Passamaquoddy chiefs, and they were negotiating and talking about the importance of tearing down a specific dam. And in my mind, as I'm sitting there listening to this, I'm thinking, times do not change, do they? It never changes for us. We see the same thing. And Maria's painting brought that to my mind.
How long have you been working on putting this together? When did that idea first come to your mind, Betsy, and you reached out to Donna?
So that was probably in late 2022, early 23. And Aaron came on to the team in 23. And I'll pass it on to him so he can talk a little bit more about that timeline.
Yeah, so from that point, we began conversations with the curators. I think the next year was really working with them, working with an advisory group that was formed, thinking about potential artists to hopefully commission works from, thinking about the permanent collections, loans. So, you know, there's so many conversations that go into just thinking about the big picture. You know, what were the topics that they wanted to address within the spaces? And visually, how does that play out? You know, which artists were really engaging with some of these topics in interesting ways? And I think with the commissions, we identified folks that were creating amazing work more generally, but then also thinking about really handing it off to them, telling them what the themes were, but then letting them run with it. And really amazing artworks came out of that. But then, we were lucky to get an implementation grant from the Terra Foundation. And from there, this whole last winter into the spring, it's arranging for artworks, building new walls, loans, those sorts of things.
Yeah, and I think...
This is Darren.
Yeah, sorry, this is Darren. I wanted just to point out again the narratives that keep interweaving throughout the exhibit. Donna mentioned, so we have Maria's piece, but then Donna mentioned, of course, this protest and attempts at a dam removal from the 18th century. And we have an amazing young Penobscot artist named Maya Atien, who has her piece, Chief Pullen died here. So it is Chief Poland who was making that that urging the settler society to remove a dam, and like many of the sort of Wabanaki diplomats, you know, he was making arguments about, you know, care that would benefit everyone. You know, like the dam is actually not just impacting native people; it's impacting anyone who would rely on this source of food in the coming years. And I think, you know, again, this is just so many layers of weaving that kind of go on to like why this exhibit, how do we as Wabanaki people engage with something like the 250th anniversary in these conditions or framings or reframings or responses, right? You know, Poland did this before the United States was a thing, but we certainly been doing it in the 250 plus years since Chief Poland, right? So I mean, so that idea of these different formulations and frameworks of guidance and how we understand what the United States is and how democracy functions as a response as Wabanaki people is so critical. So I'm just trying to highlight some of the other pieces. There are so many great artists. And I would say like we really bring in some younger artists. You know, I think there's a lot of great work being done by younger Wabanaki artists as well. And there's a real interest in, you know, really engaging in place that reveals the sort of painful or legacies of past episodes by these young artists, but they're really reimagining our territory as Wabanaki space, but dealing with some of those sort of legacies of colonization and harm. Mm.
I just want to jump in and say, this is Betsy Richards, the executive director of the Abbey. Part of the impetus for the show was this idea of dialogue on Wabanaki terms about however the dialogue wanted to happen around this thing that was coming up. And it's only been more timely that we've had executive orders that have suppressed diverse histories or any dissent with a picture of the history of the United States that isn't perfect. So it's actually even more timely. And we didn't take any federal funds for this. So we're not bound by any gag orders or anything. And really it was a lot of the curatorial happened before the election. But you know, to go back to Donna's point, a lot of the erasure of Wabanaki and other Native stories within these homelands are not told and will be left off. So it's really important that it happened anyway. So I just think it was since 2022, it's been the plan. We needed to kind of tell the story and create visibility that there are other ways of looking at this time and engaging with it. And we did that.
So, you know, it kind of reminds me of when the nine people in Charleston were shot in that church. And the guy that did it, you know, we had a meeting of everybody. It was in Merrill Auditorium. There were like 1,500 people there. And Rachel Talbot Ross sort of coordinated it. And we talked about that, what happened, because it was such a traumatic event. And one of the things that, you know, the reason that this person did this was because he wanted to start a race war. My response to that on stage in front of 1,500 people or 2,000 people was, I got news for you. We've been in a race war since 1492. And, you know, these things that are happening right now, we're kind of getting used to that. And we've always had that happening to us. And we've always had to focus on who we are and get strength from who we are in our communities and keep on moving forward and not going down different rabbit holes. you know, it's easy to do that, but for our own survival, we can't afford to do that. We have to keep our focus on our survival and telling our stories, getting things out there.
James, did you want to jump in and say a little bit about how your work was impacted, if at all, by the political climate of the time when you were working on it?
No, because I think Donna stole my thunder. You know, kind of this atmosphere that everybody else is feeling is something that's been our reality for a long time. But what I do want to touch on is a comment was made earlier about this is an art exhibit, not a history exhibit. But I think what this exhibit really highlights is there's been a departure here in this exhibit away from kind of traditional arts and to art and artists that are rooted with deep cultural and historical minded voices that, you know, Maria Gerard, like myself, is a historian. You know, Maya Atien has a very strong cultural voice. And so when you engage with artists that are who think in historical, cultural viewpoints, you tend to see a straying away from the traditional basket making, root club carving type of art. And you really get to a kind of modern art with, like I said, these deep cultural and historic views that come from Wabanaki nations today. And I think that's the real power of this exhibit.
I do want to mention that Caleb's work, his basket called Sovereign, was an eagle. He based it on an eagle image. And his thought behind that was the resilience, how it resonates with the survival of Wabanaki people. So I think that kind of highlights that point as well. You know,
I think another key frame, and you mentioned, yeah, Caleb Hoffman, Cherokee and Penobscot descendant artist, and I'm also trying to weave in Geo Neptune's piece, the Passamaquoddy artist, that sense of reflection on history and the weaving of different characters like Eagle and others, and also through basket making. It really is about, you know, one framework that Indigenous artists have started to really articulate is, and Jolene Ricard in particular has articulated as visual sovereignty, right? So this idea that we're actually drawing in an audience that may or may not, you know, be familiar with the archetypes that we use as Wabanaki people, the characters we use in our stories. You know, they might have only ever looked at Wyeth paintings, right? So they only understand, you know, landscape and place through that, but they're going to get a really different visual and cultural language by the demands on them through each of these different pieces, right? So they will learn almost like a new language of that we would say is rooted in Wabanaki forms, imagery, story, frameworks of understanding, like the wampum and the basket as a framework for weaving and articulation. You know, all of these things are going to be experienced by the people who visit this exhibit in really profound ways. And in a way, like, you know, it's not, I'm a university professor. I'd be loved to, like, you know, quiz people at the end of their experience, be like, hey, did you notice X, Y, and Z things? But quite honestly, you know, it'll wash over them and wash through them. You know, it'll become a part of a new language that they don't yet know that they're learning around how they understand us as Wabanaki people, our stories, our frameworks for engaging in something. Like, it's a little bit hard to explain, like, yeah, the United States is 250 years old. Here's a bunch of Wabanaki artists trying to figure out how we relate to it. I mean, it's a little sideways in the best of possible ways. And I think I really want to thank Betsy and the Abbey for really giving that space, right, for our visual sovereignty and for our frameworks to come across through this. Like, you know, you always worry that you know, spaces of anniversary set on the settler terms will always be just a rearticulation of their genius, you know, like, oh, woe is us, they came and now they get to celebrate 250, you know, like, but that's not what this is. It's indeed a celebration of our visual styles, of our stories and our ongoing kind of engagements with place and this ongoing history that we're a part of. So I think, yeah, just really, I encourage everyone to see the exhibit, which actually I have only seen in pictures because I was unable to come to the to the opening. But it's amazing in the pictures. I can't wait to be there.
Yeah, and I will say, and I'm not really a person that goes to museums a lot, I will say that we can truly say that this is a unique experience, this exhibit, and you won't see this anywhere else in the world. Telling you.
You're listening to Maine Currents on WERU-FM. The guests are talking about the exhibition at the Abbey Museum in Bar Harbor, which just opened, named in honor of Donna Loring's book, In the Shadow of the Eagle. The guests are Donna Loring, who also hosts Wabanaki Windows here in WERU, among other things, Betsy Richards, the executive director of the Abbey Museum, Dr. Aaron Miller, the loose curator of exhibits at the Abbey, Professor Darren Ranko, who is one of the co-curators of the exhibit and also a regular guest on Wabanaki Windows, and James Francis, an artist commissioned as part of the project.
I just want to add that we are also, so we really want folks to come see the exhibit. I would say that the works agree with the visual sovereignty piece, but I would also say that they're transcendent on their own. I mean, these are incredible artists who have a lot to say and a lot of experience. And I think folks will be surprised by the exhibit of not only what they'll learn, but also just of how much it speaks to the experience of history and of the moment. And we are going to continue to have a conversation at the Dawnland Festival of Arts and Ideas, July 12th and 13th. There's a panel that weekend where we're talking, where we're having one of the curators, Sierra Height, James Francis will be part of that panel, and also one of our advisors, Z. Crofton McDonald, who's the ambassador for the Maliseet Nation, and is also a historian, will be talking about the subject matter of the exhibit, and we invite people there. And what was really interesting, and just why I thought of this, Darren, when you mentioned that, is several of the folks on that conversation were like, can we say what we want to say on this panel? Will the Abbey allow us to? And of course, that's part of the commitment to decolonization and to centering Wabanaki voices and to power sharing, is to create the spaces and listen. And that's what we want. And we love to attract people to the Dawnland Festival that also want to listen to things that affect them, the big questions that affect them, like where's our democracy going and what are different roles in it? What kind of stories do we tell that are beyond the narrow narrative that we get? We want to invite people to that too, as well as the show. And the show will be running for 2 years. So the Dawnland Festival combines an art market like we've done for quite a long time, that is mostly Wabanaki, but other Northeastern Native artists, and performances. We've got feature performers and performers who are doing storytelling and singing. But we also have, what's added is this kind of combination of thought of Wabanaki and other Native thought leadership with the arts and culture, which for us is, for me as a Native person, I will say, I won't speak for my other colleagues, but is I think James was getting to it, is very interrelated. Many of us wear many different hats. I mean, Donna is a legislator, a former legislator, a police chief, but also an incredible playwright and poet. James is a historian and a veteran, exactly. James is a veteran himself and a historian, but an incredible artist. And for me, the sovereignty isn't just governance. It's also culture and expression. and stories and all of that. So it's all related. And so in producing this festival, we wanted to have a space where the thought leadership and the culture came together. Hopefully that the thought leadership is also on topics that matter to everybody, that matter about our democracy, that matter about the climate and our environment, that matter about our food systems, that matter about arts and culture and where technology is coming. So we would love to, if folks not only want to join us at the exhibit, but also join us for that conversation at the Dawnland Festival. It would be terrific.
Are other museums catching up at all to what you're doing, or is this really still an outlier?
I would say some. I think there was really a movement towards, you know, the of really including Indigenous voice and leadership and curatorial and making sure, you know, the easier way I would put it is a nothing about us without us museum versus kind of the gaze of the other, of kind of seeing just the anthropological view of like, you've seen more museums do that, but it's still not enough. But the Abbey was very early in on this. And, you know, it's one of the reasons I came to work here, came to, you know, was honored to take the executive director position because of the power sharing and the centering of Wabanaki folks in what we do. Wouldn't have done it otherwise.
I think also, I mean, what should be pointed out is that some of the leaders in the decolonization or the reframing and centering of Indigenous people and voice have been with tribal museums. And the Abbey is a nonprofit. It's a museum. It's not a tribal museum. It is centered on Wabanaki.
A private museum.
And I think as a private museum, it's still at the forefront of this discussion. I think there are others that have long legacies that have made moves, you know, in the last several years, but those are very large museums with resources that, you know, in a way, even when they start a new, decolonization work, you know, they get some really interesting exhibits out of that, but they're so large that the work will take so many generations, I think, you know, I'm thinking of like something like the Field Museum that's here, you know, like, yes. To really like take that on, you really have to, real work for some decades there to really kind of, even though they're making, you know, moves in certain directions, I think are really positive. So I think, I think as a private museum that is valued increasingly in the governance of the Abbey as an institution in the last 10 to 15 years, like that, the shift has not just been in exhibits. And I think this is where people don't quite get that decolonization is a little bit more than like, oh, there's native voices in the exhibit. Like, it's like a lot deeper than that. It's like a lot. It's about the governance, who's on the board, how are decisions made, how are the tribal nations themselves kind of incorporated. I mean, James mentioned like he's an appointed person onto the advisory by Penobscot Nation. You know, like, this is... Right. This wasn't always in the DNA of the Abbey. And when I was on the board, they didn't have these kinds of relations. So, when I was leaving the board, it was just starting to really take hold in really important ways. And when did I leave the board? I don't know, 2014, something like that. Anyway, Right. But that idea of like, you know,
how we treat our collections is informed
how you treat
by Wabanaki everything. People.
How,
right? So museums,
yeah.
You know, don't necessarily have those protocols that are driven by the communities that these objects are by, for, and about.
Can you be more specific? I'm not sure I'm understanding what you mean.
Aaron, do you want to take that one about the protocols around the collections?
Yeah, so there have been conversations over the years about, you know, who has access, when do they have access, you know, thinking about more sensitive materials as well. So, you know, the Abbey has returned you know, a lot to the communities, and that's always an ongoing conversation. But we really look at ourselves as caretakers, and we're always trying to build relationships that we have with the nations. So thinking about, you know, what the future looks like when it comes to the collections here and the collections at tribal museums. So, you know, we're always in the process of, I think, continuing that conversation because it's ongoing and it's always changing. You know, when it comes to really any new acquisition, whether it's a gift to the museum or, you know, a purchase, a commissioned work, we're working with the majority Wabanaki Collections Committee and Board of Trustees. So really all the substantive decisions are made very much in conversation. So, you know, Betsy said this, and I'll say it too. It's one of the reasons why I came here, because of the nature of the work that they've been doing here, but also the commitment to continuing to grow, continuing to develop those relationships. And I think situating the Abbey within this landscape of the Northeast of museums and cultural institutions in a way that the Wabanaki Nations want it to be.
I just want to add that part of, since I've started, we've gone through a strategic planning process. And this does tie back to the exhibit of why this exhibit. We have always had an educational mission. And one of the things that we are working on is to not only educate our audiences about the different Wabanaki nations, the nations that are part of the Wabanaki Confederacy, history, culture, futures, but it's also to activate our audiences and to not let them know what they can do or what they can understand that will have them be different in the world. And this exhibit really ties into that, really kind of gives you another angle into thinking about a Wabanaki understanding of this country, both the pieces that intersect and the things that don't, or the things that these nations have been here for millennia and way, way before this experiment of the United States. And we hope that the audience will come away with more information about sovereignty, about Wabanaki diplomacy, about the incredible service of Wabanaki veterans, and about just interaction, both the good and the bad.
How has the reaction been among people that have been in since the exhibit opened?
But, you know, it's interesting. The Abbey, I think Darren talked about this earlier, you know, thinking about the audiences, you know, most people who are coming in and not know anything about the Wabanaki Nations. They're not from here on any level. So, you know, I'm always asking folks, you know, who kind of run the front line of the museum, you know, what are they hearing? And I feel like the reaction's been very favorable. Hear a lot of positive things. I mean, that's always what you want to hear when you work at a museum. But I think people are surprised. I think they're learning. I think they're blown away by the artworks. You know, using contemporary art as the entry point, I think is a great way to bring people in. And I feel like they're leaving, you know, with their eyes open a little bit.
James, I saw you took yourself off mute and I was hoping you were going to jump in there. Do you have something else you want to say?
I've always said that the Abbey Museum is number one in decolonizing museums in the world. Even if we have to do that alphabetically, but I think they are the number one museum in the world on decolonizing.
All right. I'll see if I can find one of those boom, boom sounds to put in there. Anybody else?
Oh, I just want to say, again, just to reinforce, like, it is a really special show with a lot of amazing artworks. Like, and I think, it tells a really special story that will add depth and understanding to any visitor. You know, I think in terms of, like, you know, you wouldn't go to the Abbey Museum, right, with its mission to see some, you know, medals from George Washington and you know, whatever, blah, 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 blah. Like, you you're expecting something that is really unique. And it's not, it's driven by story, right? It is not driven by, I mean, there's critiques of colonialism and the United States in it, but it is driven by Wabanaki stories. This is a an expression of ongoing works by very creative, living Wabanaki people reflecting on our place, past, present, and future in our own homelands, in dealing with this thing called the United States and all of these other kinds of situations and how we have participated in that. So I think the veterans piece, you know, that part of it really drives home just how strongly we've been also participating as Wabanaki people in this various projects that we call the United States.
Donna, can people still order your book through like small bookstores if they went to an independent bookstore? When I Googled it, I found it on Amazon, but a lot of people don't like to shop there.
Yeah, I think there are some.
The Abbey Museum Shop sells Donna's book.
Yes, please. We sell it.
All right.
There please come by.
If you're lucky, you'll catch Donna there and get an autographed copy.
Yeah, signed copies, Donna.
Look at that.
All right, Betsy, do you want to do the honors of wrapping it up?
Sure. Well, we invite everybody to come see the exhibition In the Shadow of the Eagle at the Abbey Museum. We are open Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Our website is www.abbemuseum.org. We also have the Dawnland Festival on our landing page at the Abbey Museum. It is July 12th and 13th, hosted by the Abbey Museum, but it's at the College of the Atlantic. And the panel that I talked about, that festival is happening from 9 to 5 p.m. also on that Saturday and Sunday. And the panel that I talked about, Centering Wabanaki Voices in America's 250th, is happening at 2:30 in the afternoon on Sunday, July 13th. So we'd love to have everybody come by the Abbey and by the Dawnland Festival.
That was Donna Loring, Betsy Richards, Aaron Miller, Darren Ranko, and James Francis. They're all part of the Abbey Museum's In the Shadow of the Eagle exhibition that will be shown at the Abbey for the next 2 years. The Abbey is in Bar Harbor, and you can find their website at abbemuseum.org. And don't forget, Wabanaki Windows is on every month on the fourth Tuesday of the month from 4 to 5 p.m. You've been listening to Maine Currents, which is now a pop-up show. We just pop up when we have a show in different places in the schedule. You can find our previous editions on the archives at weru.org. Thanks for listening. I'm Amy Brown. Take care and keep it tuned here to WERU-FM 89.9 Blue Hill and streaming online at weru.org.